Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from chalk to chewing gum. In this week's show, we're taking another look at science education. We'll learn about an eye-catching classroom demonstration and find out how the internet is changing the way the public learns about science. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Each spring, the Chemical Heritage Foundation brings together major education policymakers for the annual Leadership in Science Education, or LISE, conference. The theme of this year's conference is New Media and Technology in Science Education, a topic close to our hearts. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably realize that there's a whole world of educational material online that would have been unimaginable even 5 years ago. Blogs, audio podcasts, YouTube videos, all of these have transformed the knowledge economy. The Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project has been key in investigating what information is out there and how people use what they find. Distillations executive producer Audra Wolf spoke with John Horrigan, associate director for research on this project and a speaker at CHF's recent LISE conference. They talked about how online media and social networking sites are changing science education.
Thanks for joining us, John.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be at the LISE conference in Philadelphia.
Well, I want to start with a definitional question. Can you tell us what Web 2.0 technologies are?
Web 2.0 technologies are technologies that allow for participation and interaction on the World Wide Web. And the platform for Web 2.0 is basically broadband to the home. That enables people to go to their always-on internet connection and upload their blog, update a video that they might want to upload to YouTube. So Web 2.0 allows participation, and it runs on broadband internet at the home.
So how are these new Web 2.0 technologies changing science education?
Web 2.0 technologies represent a challenge for science because you have a generation of users who are used to participating online as they conduct their various conversations using Web 2.0 technologies. The challenge for science educators and science news hounds, those who want to get news out to the general media, is to pull participation into how you present a message about a particular science story or a particular bit of science education that you want to get across. So it's about trying to pull users into the participatory space of science using these technologies.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that part of what's different is a loss of control for the people who are presenting the information or trying to teach the information.
That's right. Web 2.0 always presents trust challenges or trust issues for people trying to disseminate information. When you're trying to get a message out, you're going to try to pull users into conversations about the topic that you're interested in, and conversations are inherently uncertain, which means a loss of control, which means you have to be willing to put up with that as you put these messages out and allow users to converse, create, participate, and sometimes disrupt what was initially intended as the message.
Can you tell us about who listens to, say, educational podcasts?
We've done some research on people listening to podcasts, and something on the order of 10% of internet users say that they'll listen to podcasts from time to time, and it's going to be young people who are interested in podcasts. I also suspect it's people with commutes on public transportation a great deal.
One last question. Do you care to make any predictions for the future of, you know, Web 2.0 and its interactive technologies for education?
I think Web 2.0 will be mobile soon. I don't know if they'll call it Web 2.0. 2.5 or Web 3.0, but increasingly we see users embracing mobile technologies, the BlackBerry, the handheld device, as basically an overlay onto the always-on home broadband experience. So people's expectations, particularly young people, will be that the handheld device is going to be an on-ramp to all sorts of mobile media applications. And that's only going to get more powerful as the devices get more powerful and as we get more ubiquitous high-speed wireless networks.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John Horrigan is Associate Director for Research at the Pew Internet and American Life Project. For more on this year's LISE conference and summary documents from previous years, check out our website at distillations.chemheritage.org. a surprising number of tabletop chemistry experiments have found a large following online. Remember the Mentos and the Diet Coke bottle experiment from a few years back? The video clips of these are often meant to entertain rather than teach, but there are lessons to be learned from these online demonstrations. Jennifer Dionisio has the method behind the magic for one of these videos in today's Element of the Week.
One of the videos making the rounds on tech blogs last fall shows a beaker filled with an amber fluid sitting on top of a magnetic stirrer. A gloved hand emerges and pours in a clear liquid. The contents of the beaker immediately turn dark blue, then fade to light blue, then clear, then back to amber, before suddenly turning dark again. The cycle repeats several times with no more intervention than the humming of a stir bar. This demonstration, known as the Briggs-Rauscher oscillating reaction, was developed by a pair of chemistry teachers in the 1970s to wow their students. But it also teaches some basic concepts about halide chemistry and feedback loops. The exact mechanism of the Briggs-Rauscher reaction is quite complicated and involves various forms of the element iodine, a halide that's solid at room temperature. Like all halides, iodine's outer electron shell contains an unstable 7 electrons. It typically comes bonded in pairs or appears as an ion with an extra electron. Under certain conditions, however, the unstable version of iodine appears as an intermediate in reactions. An atom with an odd number of electrons in its outer shell is called a free radical, and that's part of what's driving the reaction we're seeing in this video. To perform the reaction, you start with three different solutions that contain the following: oxidized iodine in the form of an iodate compound, hydrogen peroxide, a strong inorganic acid like sulfuric acid, a weaker organic acid, typically malonic acid, starch, and a manganese compound. When all of these elements are combined, two different reactions begin, one dependent on a free radical and one not. Each reaction creates a product that feeds the other one, pushing the equilibrium back and forth between the two. You see amber when the concentration of diatomic iodine increases, and dark blue when iodide ions and diatomic iodine binds to the starch. The cycle repeats for 3 to 5 minutes until the system finally achieves equilibrium. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. We posted a link to the most popular Briggs-Rauscher oscillation reaction video on our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Finally today, while online videos and other internet resources provide myriad supplemental materials, many educators are increasingly worried about what's missing from their actual classrooms, in large part due to recent government legislation. Veteran teacher and science coach Abigail Paskey has this commentary.
I had been teaching science and math in urban public schools for 3 years when No Child Left Behind was signed into law in 2002, and since then, I've developed a love-hate relationship with the policy. The great thing about NCLB is that it holds disadvantaged kids to a high standard. Data shows that kids of color and really poor kids of any color nationwide have lower test scores and drop out of high school at a higher rate than other kids. NCLB assumes that schools are failing these kids because they have less qualified teachers and so fall behind grade level early on in their education. All children deserve the opportunity to receive a quality education from trained professionals. Under NCLB, kids are promised real chemistry knowledge in clearly defined lessons, and the amount of real chemistry they get is measured because kids take a big test on it at the end of the year. And this is where my faith in No Child Left Behind fails. First, the testing varies from state to state. In California, science success is determined with a multiple choice test given at the end of each high school year in biology, chemistry, physics, or earth science. But are we teaching kids the valuable science content and critical thinking skills they need to succeed in later science courses or college? Or are we just teaching them how to take tests well? No time to do labs, we have to prepare for the test. No amount of learning about the scientific process can actually replace the real thing. Coming up with a hypothesis, testing it, collecting data and analyzing it, drawing conclusions from strong evidence, and supporting those conclusions well enough to communicate them to an audience. That needs to be the focus of our teaching day. Second, highly qualified teachers are a big selling point of NCLB. Teachers must have the proper credentials. But does passing a standardized test on content knowledge make a teacher a good teacher? A college professor of chemistry knows her content, but how would she fare in front of 30 12-year-old kids? Rather than creating barriers for people attempting to enter the teaching profession, it would make more sense to better support those teachers once they're in the classroom by providing them with days off to observe successful teachers, intense coaching, strong professional development, working lab equipment, and textbooks. No Child Left Behind has redefined high-stakes testing for kids, for teachers, and for schools. Perhaps the best thing NCLB has done is to put our public education system in the spotlight, with all its successes and shortcomings. But honestly, No Child Left Behind is not what I think about as I walk in the doors of school every morning. I think about my students and the learning that will go on in my classroom that day. As it stands right now, No Child Left Behind is just part of the complicated, wonderful, frustrating world of public education. For Distillations, I'm Abigail Paskey.
Abigail Paskey is a science and math teacher and coach at Urban Promise Academy in Oakland, California. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the state of science education in today's classrooms. Send your comments to distillations@chemheritage.org. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein, speaking about the education of her son. Teach him to think for himself? Oh my God! Teach him, rather, to think like other people. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro. And our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided by Andrew Chalfin and from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.